I'm joined now by Professor James Cordes from Cornell University. You're a professor at Cornell. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Now, you are here joining in a conference which Manchester has been holding on pulsars. So is that your main field of research?
It has been for about 30 years. So I think we could say that. I've branched out on a few other things, but it's I always come back to pulsars. And I even every 10 years have the thought, gee, I should do something else. But pulsars keep giving and giving.
What's the attraction for you for studying pulsars?
The attraction, I guess there are a few of them. One is that they're really bizarre astrophysical objects, for one. I think the other is that, well, they're bizarre astrophysical objects, but the kinds of physics that you can probe by studying pulsars is immense. I mean, it ranges from, say, condensed matter physics. Imagine things at densities such that if you had a teaspoonful of the material, it would weigh 100 million tons. You know, that's pretty exotic. And then these things radiate in ways that nothing else in the universe does. You can use them as clocks to probe gravity. They have all kinds of maybe not day-to-day type practical applications, but certainly from a scientific point of view, they're very practical.
Remind us just briefly what a pulsar is and how it forms.
Right. Well, a pulsar is a type of neutron star. We believe that most, if not all, of these objects form in supernova explosions. So you have a massive star, maybe 10 times the mass of the sun. The core of the star implodes and the rest of the star explodes. And what's left over in that core is a neutron. It's either going to be a neutron star or a black hole. As the core of the star implodes, if it becomes either a black hole or a neutron star, it's going to be spinning very rapidly. The other thing that happens is the magnetic field builds up. So you've got this combination of spin and high magnetic field. That combination produces electricity that can accelerate particles that radiate emission, and which we can detect quite readily. So these things are exotic. They're about 10 kilometers in radius, so the size of, you know, a typical city. They have as much mass, if actually more mass, than what the sun has. So all packed into that small volume.
Mm. And how do we detect them?
We detect them because the combination of spin and the radiation is that the radiation is beamed. So it's very much like a lighthouse with its lamp spinning around and beamed. So if that beam points at us once per rotation, we'll see a pulse. And then because of the rotation, we see a repetition of that pulse. Mm. Hence the name pulsars.
Now, we've heard before on the Jodcast about all the exciting physics you can do with pulsars from Michael Kramer, particularly in testing Einstein's general theory of relativity down to extremely high precision. You are working on an interesting field currently on pulsars, about pulsars which turn themselves off occasionally and then back on again. Tell us a bit about this.
Okay, well, that is a sort of a hot area. We've gotten accustomed over the last 40-plus years since pulsars were discovered to think of them as these nicely periodic objects where basically you see the lighthouse regularly, you can count on it being there. But what we also know is that the methods that we use to survey the sky to find these things have also relied on that periodicity, if you want to call it that, as part of our scheme for finding them. And as a consequence, we've missed those objects that for whatever reason that nature has come up with are not so reliable. They're not repetitive. They'll burst, they'll spit out a few pulses, and then they'll be quiet for maybe an hour, maybe a month. So those things we have not done such a good job on finding. A few years ago, we started applying algorithms that would let us see those things, and we have found some of them. And what's interesting, it looks like if you talk about the Milky Way galaxy that we live in, and ask, well, how many neutron stars are of the ordinary pulsar type and how many are these intermittent type, the numbers are probably about the same or very similar.
We're missing half of the pulsars.
Yeah, exactly. And if our government were to conduct a census and didn't count half the people, I think there would be an uproar, right?
Well, certainly there could be some poor conclusions drawn about the population.
Right. Yes.
So pulsar surveys have been conducted in the past, and presumably, as you say, some of the pulsars, 50% of the pulsars possibly, simply weren't going beep at the time.
Right.
So what could possibly be the reason why a pulsar, this really dense object, which seems unstoppable with its angular momentum and producing these pulses, how do you turn it off?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the things are obviously spinning. That doesn't stop. They're like a spinning top, like a gyroscope, that you can't shut that off, but you can shut off the radiation. So it's sort of like the guy in the lighthouse with his hand on the light switch and playing games on us. So I think the honest answer is that we don't really understand the intermittency of these things. But we have some ideas, and one of my pet ideas is that, well, the way that these things work is the neutron star is highly magnetized. Because of the spin, as I said before, they generate electricity. That those electric forces accelerate particles and produce the radiation. Now, that whole chain of events can get disrupted if, for example, material from outside the pulsar were to enter its magnetosphere, as we call it. And indeed, we think that may be what's taking place for these intermittent pulsars. So, for example, a student of mine and I have done an analysis looking at the situation where if there's an asteroid belt around a neutron star, that's perhaps a big if, but you can make a good case for it, and I could talk about that. But if you have such an asteroid belt or just a collection of rocks, you don't need a lot of material, but if those rocks individually spiral in and enter the magnetosphere, they will disrupt that whole chain of events that leads to the radio emission that we see.
Presumably, these asteroids are, well, they're much, much larger in relative size to a neutron star than asteroids would be to our own sun, for instance.
That's correct.
So you're talking about the asteroids actually physically impacting the neutron star or just passing close? Or
no, it's actually a very interesting process. A rock-like object, let's say an asteroid that's maybe 100 meters in size, maybe a kilometer in size. As you say, that's pretty big relative to the neutron star. But anyway, those things cannot get all that close to the neutron star because the neutron star is this kind of monster-type object. It's hot. It's about 1,000,000 degrees temperature, so it radiates ultraviolet and X-ray light, and that light can evaporate the asteroid. You've also got this other radiation coming from the magnetosphere. That can evaporate the asteroid. So it's sort of a game of what happens first. Does the asteroid get in close enough, or does it get evaporated too far from the neutron star to make a difference? And the answer to that question depends on what kind of pulsar you have. Some pulsars are spinning very quickly, hundreds of times per second. Others are spinning maybe more like once per second. It's the slow ones that tend to be older and a little cooler. We think the asteroids can get into the magnetosphere. But they don't get all that far. They do get evaporated. But they've gotten in close enough to do the damage.
Especially to disrupt the radiation coming off the neutron star, the spinning neutron star.
Or really, it's the radiation coming from the magnetosphere. Because the radio emission that we see or detect is actually coming from the magnetic field surrounding the neutron star, not from the neutron star object itself.
How likely is it then to have a neutron star surrounded by a field of asteroids? Because you mentioned that these neutron stars were formed through a supernova explosion, usually.
Yes.
And presumably that means all the stuff went bang outwards and there shouldn't be too much stuff left.
That's a very good question. And we're used to seeing these dramatic pictures of supernovae where the material is flying out at 10,000 kilometers per second and producing these nice nebulae that we can see with different telescopes. But not all the material is ejected. So people have done these simulation studies, and it looks like there is what's called fallback material. Some of it simply does not have adequate speed it doesn't have escape velocity. So some of that material falls back, it doesn't really fall back onto the collapsing object. Instead, it goes into orbit around that object. So it's very similar in many respects to what the solar system looked like early on. We had this object that was collapsing to form the sun, but there was also all this material that was in orbit in a disk that produced the planets, that formed the planets. More or less the same geometry, the same picture that you can visualize that way, we think is what's happening around some of these neutron stars. So you have a fallback disk. That disk can then form rocks. The material in that disk is probably far too small to form planets. So that's why we tend to not see planets around neutron stars, with one or two exceptions. So that's the basic picture, is you've got this fallback material. It cools off and becomes neutral instead of ionized, and it gradually forms rocks, maybe over a period of about 10,000 years. And then the material will migrate in.
It's a standing question at the moment is planetary formation, how do planets form around normal stars? And the big problem that people are having is how do you get a pile of gas and dust to form little planetesimal objects and then forming planets? I mean, this sounds like a very similar sort of problem. So can your research, if this theory is correct, can the rate at which bits of material, stellar material, form and then fall onto a pulsar, which you can then measure because it turns it off every so often, does that help us? Is there some connection between the two fields, do you think?
It's hard to say, but I think the material that would be in a fallback disk is probably more metal-rich than the material that formed the solar system. The reason I say that is because the star that explodes to form the supernova and form the neutron star has much heavier elements, higher atomic numbers than your typical interstellar gas, as we call it. And the sun formed out of typical interstellar gas. It's a little unclear. I'm not sure if what we would learn about pulsars tells us much about formation of planets like ours, but it certainly tells us about, well, the conditions around neutron stars, how the radiation mechanisms work. I think that's useful information also for perhaps understanding objects that are yet to be discovered.
One question which interests me, you mentioned that these pulsars are radiating strongly in the UV, a million degrees on the surface.
Yes.
Can we actually see these in the UV? Can we get UV photometry on these things?
Not so much the UV, but in the X-ray band, a number of pulsars have been seen. And again, there are several emission mechanisms, one from the magnetosphere, another that's really the direct thermal radiation from the surface of the star. So it's just the fact that it's hot, and that has been seen in maybe a few dozen objects.
How many of these intermittent pulsars are known?
Okay, this is new territory. We only know of about 20, and the reason the number is so small is in part because we haven't done all that great a job of surveying the Milky Way yet, and that's interesting because that means there are more objects to be discovered. But also, they are intermittent, so they're harder to detect. So actually, we need new types of telescopes that will allow us to probe the sky very efficiently and discover these new things.
Because presumably, when you were first making the survey of pulsars in the sky, you would assume, oh, there's a pulsar. It'll be there tomorrow. It'll be there next year. How were these intermittent pulsars discovered? Did people go back to a known pulsar position and it wasn't there, or did they turn off while we were looking at them? How were they discovered as being intermittent?
Well, there are actually several different kinds, but the ones that were discovered recently are ones that are very intermittent. They're usually off. They may be on for they may emit a couple of pulses and then be off for hours. That type of thing. And so if you imagine that you've got the Milky Way peppered with these kinds of objects, in some sense, it doesn't matter where you look. You can be scanning the sky. So in the course of taking data for ordinary pulsar surveys, you can look at the data with different computer algorithms to try to find the intermittent ones. And basically, before about the mid-1990s, nobody bothered to do that kind of analysis. We started doing it in the 1990s at Cornell, and then one of my students helped reprocess some of the data taken for a major survey done in Australia, and that's the analysis that discovered this new class of objects.
That's very exciting stuff. So intermittent pulsars as a research topic for you is part of a larger research interest of the time variable universe. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, that's a hot area, not just in radio astronomy, but pretty much all across the spectrum, from radio to optical to X-rays and gamma rays. And what we've come to realize, really, and it's not a new idea by any means, I think many people have heard of gamma ray bursts. They were discovered by accident by spy satellites, basically, looking for gamma rays from atomic explosions. And lo and behold, these satellites detected bursts coming from above, not coming from below. You know, that's a great historical example of the discovery of things that go boom in the night. And I think the point is it's much harder to study the sky if, as you say, we can't count on an object appearing and being observable from one day to the next. So instead, if you've got things that are highly intermittent, well, number one, we don't really know what the universe looks like in any kind of detailed way all across the electromagnetic spectrum. So why is it important to look across the whole spectrum? Well, the sky looks different at different wavelengths or in the radio band compared to gamma rays and optical. And some objects appear in only one or a few of those bands, not all of them. So if you want a comprehensive view of what's out there, you pretty much need to cover the whole spectrum. And as I said, it's much harder to do that, and so that means continuously we have to improve telescopes. So there's a project for optical astronomy called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. It's supposed to come online sometime next decade, and it will be doing a comprehensive mapping of the sky. It'll map the whole available sky every night, over and over again, looking for these transient sources, if you want to call them that.
Comprehensive is sort of an understatement, isn't it? It's like a vacuum cleaner. Does the whole sky every night, or at least the whole sky it can see.
The whole sky it can
every
see.
Night. It's remarkable.
That's right. And so in terms of the data, these things are very data intensive. So that particular project, it'll generate something like 10,000 gigabytes of data every night, which sounds crazy to us now, but 5-8 years from now, it'll seem very simple to deal with. So that's one aspect of it for the optical. For the radio, at radio wavelengths, there are several projects now, telescopes being built or planned. One of them is in Australia called the Murchison Wide Field Array, operating at frequencies close to the FM band, actually. And it will be able to survey the sky at any instant. It'll be looking at many tens of square degrees, so a big chunk of the sky at any one time. So if there are these intermittent transient things, they will certainly be seen. And we're sure that there are, because we already know of some classes of such objects. But the really exciting thing is that I would say it's guaranteed we'll find new things. And what those might be, well, if they're really new, how can we predict? But you can speculate, and I would say something along the lines of maybe some kinds of planets that are orbiting close to their stars will produce intermittent radiation. Jupiter actually does that in our solar system, but it's because of its orbiting satellite Io, which orbits close to Jupiter. There's this intermittency. But the same thing could be true for extrasolar planets. So that's one class of object which you can is guaranteed to exist, I think. The question is, how bright are they? Can we detect them? Another one, a real wild card, I think, is other civilizations that are out there. They may be transmitting FM radio like we do, analogously, or they might be transmitting radar signals the way we do for our aircraft. But also, this is one of the things that my former colleague Carl Sagan used to talk about. Any advanced civilization will have to guard its planet against asteroid impacts. And one of the best ways to track asteroids is with radar. So you bounce radio signals off them, you can determine their orbits, and you can then check whether that asteroid is on a collision course or not. So those kinds of radars are very powerful, and they could be seen across great distances in the galaxy.
So you're speculating that extraterrestrial intelligence will be using this sort of system to be making sure that that asteroid coming towards their planet is actually going to miss them.
That's exactly right. And it's rampant speculation, but it's a plausible kind of thing. And it would, of course, we would see this very intermittently. Hmm. We would have to be looking in the right direction at the right time in order to detect those things. And then there are other astrophysical type objects that you can think about. So that array in Australia is one example. Another one that actually Michael Kramer and I are working on together is the planning for the Square Kilometer Array, which will be built starting sometime next decade. That'll be operating at somewhat higher frequencies. But one of the things I'm really pushing for is that it have this capability of characterizing the sky in this time variable way, the intermittent way. And so I like to kind of paraphrase Heraclitus, who said, you don't step in the same river twice, and what I would say is you don't see the same universe twice.
Exciting stuff, isn't it? I mean, they do say that you build a new telescope, you observe in a new wavelength band, you observe the universe again and again every night, you're bound to learn something new. I mean, that will bring new science, so it's exciting times.
It really is, and that's, I think, what attracts many people into astronomy, because it's high tech, for one thing, but it's also you're probing nature in the most fundamental way.
Let's talk about one more transient phenomena. Let's talk about rats. Rats.
Well, rats we kind of talked about already. Those are the rotating, it's RRAT, rotating radio transient. These were the objects that were found in this reanalysis of other survey data, and where just a few pulses were seen from a given direction. So initially, it wasn't clear what kind of objects these were. You know, were they just one-off type bursts, or were they repetitive? So by reobserving some of these objects once a burst was seen from a given direction on the sky, some of them turned out to be repetitive, the way a pulsar is, just more modulated or intermittent. And so it became natural to think that, well, there must be a rotating object that's accounting for those objects. And so instead of calling it a pulsar right away, rotating radio transient became the name. So now you see when people give talks about these objects, they have little cartoons of rats and of the rodent type on their view graphs or slides. But some of them, it isn't so clear whether they're the same kind of object because we haven't seen them repeat. And for me, it'd be more exciting if it's something besides a neutron star, actually.
Very good. We'll wait for the jury to come back in on that one.
Right.
Now, you've done observations at Arecibo.
That's correct.
It's a wonderful instrument. And do tell us a little bit about what it's like to observe in Arecibo.
Well, Arecibo is in the tropics, so it's in the mountainous region of Puerto Rico. It's built into a sinkhole. Arecibo still is the world's largest aperture as an antenna. And so as such, it's an incredibly powerful telescope, especially good for pulsar work. It's great to go there. It has a long history of fostering an experimental aspect of using technology, basically doing experiments with instrumentation and looking at the sky in new ways, as well as doing more routine things. So it's a great place because it is so sensitive and it has this experimental aspect to it. Right now, with funding in the U.S., it's Arecibo and some other telescopes are under threat of being closed down. And so what we're trying to do at Cornell is to find a new business model that will allow Arecibo to keep going.
Would that include private sponsorship or sale of time to other institutions? Where do you get money to run something like Arecibo?
Yeah, it's difficult because in the U.S., and I think this is true around the world, radio astronomy has been funded by governments. scientific funding agencies, the National Science Foundation in the case of the U.S., and that's been true ever since World War II. We live in different times now, and if you look at if by comparison you look at the optical community, optical telescopes, well, many of them have been funded privately, at least in the U.S. And so what the National Science Foundation is now promoting is basically partnerships where it may be some mixture of private and public funding. But we need to take the first step on that. And I think just given the overall financial times, maybe especially this last week, we need to be creative on how we do this. But we have a lot going for us because astronomy of all types appeals to many people. And so it, as such, it gets a lot of support from the public. And there may be ways of attracting some private money for that purpose. Easier said than done, but we have to try.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, glad to do it, Nick.